The earthworks that were built nearly 2,000 years ago across the Midwest were not random. They include places in Ohio that are recognized as important World Heritage Sites.
Octagons and squares and circles connected by lines. It's an odd sort of set of earthenworks there.
Coming up, we'll look at the mound builder mysteries of Ohio's ancient trail. It takes commitment to maintain heritage sites like these. The head of the World Monuments Fund reminds us how preservation projects can bring us together as we protect places that are at risk of disappearing in our communities and around the world.
America is amazing, first of all, because of its philanthropic culture. And we have to preserve that because it enriches you as humans.
Plus, a transcontinental pilot tells us what it's like to land a jet airplane.
Pilots will often joke that, you know, no one has to take off, but we do need to land.
It's all in the hour ahead on Travel with Rick Steves. You can travel all the way to Stonehenge in England to explore a mysterious site and imagine what it was all about in the distant past. But there are also impressive prehistoric sites in North America, even where you might least expect them. In a minute, Lori Erickson reminds us that earthwork sites, like the Great Serpent Mound in Ohio, serve as a link with the people who came before us. How do you protect important heritage sites from the ravages of time and other threats? Since 1965, the World Monuments Fund has been trying to safeguard what's irreplaceable around the world. Their latest list adds 24 heritage places in need of protection, from ancient cities to modern icons. And this time, it even includes what we left behind on the moon. In just a bit, the head of the WMF reminds us of the mission to preserve a piece of ourselves in the World Heritage Sites around us. And would you like to know what it feels like to work as a jet pilot taking people across the ocean? Mark Van Honecker wrote a fun little guide called How to Land a Plane. He joins us later in the hour for some reassurance from the cockpit. The people of Ohio are proud to have their first UNESCO World Heritage Site. In 2023, several prehistoric Hopewell ceremonial earthworks across central Ohio were given that honor. They serve as a witness to the brilliance of the societies who came long before us and built earthwork monuments aligned with the rhythms of the sun and the moon. Lori Erickson has made pilgrimages to important sites across the U.S. from Appalachia to Alaska. She explores them in her book, Every Step is Home. And she's with us now on Travel with Rick Steves to take a closer look at Ohio's ancient trail. Lori, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So Lori, there's actually a culture right here in our country that goes back 1800 years, the Hopewell culture. Tell us who they were.
Well, in some ways, we don't know a lot about them because we have no written records. The oral tradition it's too far in the past to have a living oral tradition. But what we do have are these remarkable earthenworks that were created by this culture. So they're named the Hopewell culture after the name of the farmer who owned the land where one of these first mounds was excavated on. But otherwise, Hopewell doesn't have any connection with what the people themselves called their culture. There are four main sites on the ancient Ohio Trail. There are thousands of mound sites, but the four main ones are Newark, which is the largest set of geometric earthworks in the world. It's near Columbus. And if you look at an aerial map, it looks almost like a semiconductor map. You know, there are octagons and squares and circles connected by lines. It's an odd sort of set of earthenworks there. Mound City is another area, maybe about a half-hour drive or so away. That was a necropolis, a burial place. It looks like giant anthills spread out over a couple of football fields. Fort Ancient is the third one. It was the largest hilltop enclosure in North America. It's on a beautiful setting overlooking a river. And it's a puzzle because there were, in this hilltop enclosure, there were 70 different openings. And so it clearly wasn't meant for defensive purposes because you wouldn't have that many openings in it. So it was used for some kind of ceremony. And it's huge. And then the fourth one is the one that is most impressive, that captures people's imaginations in all sorts of ways. It's the Great Serpent Mound. It is the largest effigy mound in the world. It's a huge serpent, a quarter mile in length. Each of the curves are about 3 feet high. Originally, they would have been even higher than that. The Great Serpent Mound is a little bit of an anomaly. It probably wasn't Hopewell. It was built either before or after. But it's connected to this ancient Ohio trail, and it is a really impressive spot.
Now, this faces the setting sun, I understand, just like, you know, all of the stone circles and these remnants of civilizations in Europe and in England. And they all seem to be lined up with the stars and the rising setting sun on summer solstice. And there's a connection there, isn't there?
Well, it doesn't. It seems like it's too much of a coincidence that the mouth of the serpent would face the setting sun on the solstice. Another interesting quirk of this site is that deep below the serpent is the remains of a meteor crater. Big meteor struck the area about 300 million years ago, and it twisted the rock there in ways that it's not apparent from the surface. But there are, if you have a compass and you're walking around the Great Serpent, it does weird things. And it has to do with, there are geological explanations for that. But I think it's interesting to speculate on the fact that the people perhaps who built the Great Serpent effigy realized that there were a variety of reasons why this place was different.
Lori Erickson is an Episcopal clergywoman from Iowa City who often visits and writes about significant spiritual sites around the world. She's with us right now from the Travel with Rick Steves archives to look at Ohio's ancient trail of mound builder sites. She wrote about them in her book, Every Step is Home, based on road trip discoveries she and her husband had exploring sites across America that seem to have a special resonance. Her website is LoriErickson.net, and Lori is spelled L-O-R-I. Lori, how does this relate to indigenous Americans that we think of, you know, tribes that we all know? Is this Hopewell culture as mysterious to them as even more so than they are to us?
Well, I think the Shawnee in particular claim an ancestral connection to these sites, and that it almost certainly is their ancestors who were there. Because of the tremendous disruptions in Native American culture, the diseases and you know, all the terrible things that happened to various tribal groups, that it's not a direct connection anymore, but there is a reclaiming of that heritage. Mm. And the Park Service in Ohio is working really hard to collaborate with the Native peoples to try to bring to life the stories, the older traditions, as much as they can.
I would think it's a bit of a challenge, especially with the Native American interest in making sure these are respected as holy sites. Some of them are sites that are holy to golfers or developers more than holy to Native American heritage. I would imagine that's a bit of a discussion in Ohio.
Well, it is. And I think it's always hard when you have sacred sites, indigenous sites that are in the midst of modern development. And so you mentioned the Mound Builders Country Club. It contains part of the Newark Earthworks, and there are negotiations underway to take it back under the control of the State Historical Society. I think another thing that happens at the Great Serpent Mound, it's become a center for New Age pilgrims and for people who, you know, in various ways connect with nature spirituality. And so there's somewhat of a delicate dance relating to that. It's a public place. It's a spiritual place. It's a Native American place. And so there are a lot of different stories that come together there. Hmm. But I think as long as people come with a sense of respect and openness, that can be a good thing. You know, in part, what I like about these places is that the story is so open. You know, there's not one set, there's not a book about it. There's not one particular set of dogma or rules about it. Instead, there's mystery at the heart of it. Mm. And I think that people respond to that, the power of the mystery.
If somebody wants to visit, I would think it'd be nice to have some kind of a museum where you might have a few artifacts and some sort of a sense of what was the technology and what do we know about these people. Is there a museum and are there artifacts and what's that like?
Yes, there are some. In Columbus, Ohio, called the History Connection Museum, that would be the best place to go. At Fort Ancient, they have quite a nice museum there that has some of the artifacts and some replica artifacts. It's in the works that these sites are going to be named UNESCO World Heritage Sites. They're on the short list for that. If and when that happens, I think that's going to raise the profile of these places tremendously, because I think a lot of people just don't realize how significant they are. They really are the American Stonehenge or the American pyramids. And unfortunately, because they were built of earth, they've sunk down a lot. You know, you have to use some imagination with them. But the amount of work, the sophistication, the lunar alignments, the astronomical alignments, all of those indicate an incredibly sophisticated culture that built these places.
Fascinating. Lori Erickson is joining us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio to explore Ohio's ancient trail of mound builder sites. For more recent indigenous history, Ohio has opened the Great Council State Park. It's on the site of an 18th century Shawnee village, just north of Xenia. It also has displays on the Hopewell and Fort Ancient cultures, with their mound sites just a short drive away. Lori, when we think of this ancient Ohio trail, you can't help but wonder, what was the technology of the age, and how did they build this stuff? I mean, when we go to that museum, what kind of artifacts will we see? What physical remnants are there from the Hopewell people?
Well, if you go to the museum, you'll see artifacts that are made of mica and copper and seashells and obsidian that were traded throughout North America, which indicates that it was a powerful culture that had connections across the continent. But the technology itself used to build these mounds was very simple. They had probably pointed sticks, they had hoes made out of clamshells, and they had woven baskets, and they had human labor. But then the other part of that, the process that I think is really important to realize, is that this was not a hierarchical culture. You know, like when the pyramids were built, for example, there was a pharaoh who was telling people what to do. But instead, these cultures, these early Hopewell cultures, were primarily hunter-gatherers. They did some limited agriculture, but primarily they lived in small groups without a big social structure, you know, with the elite living in wealthy places and the rest of people living in pretty minimal circumstances. So whatever the motivation was, it almost certainly was done in a voluntary fashion. And they also almost certainly didn't live at these places. And so they were used for ceremonial purposes. So probably people came together from a considerable distance to work on the earthen works. And then they'd have ceremonies and then they would go away. And so there's real differences between some of these monuments and, say, the Central American monuments that were built essentially by slave labor and in Europe as well.
That is so important that we're able to just remember that we don't need to leave our country to find distant history. I mean, I'm so used to thinking, oh, we've got history here a couple centuries ago, but we're talking 1800 years ago, remnants of communities that worked together. And it's a blessing to be able to see it. And what we need to do is remember the ancient Ohio Trail. Lori Erickson, thank you so much for joining us. And I've got some interesting travels ahead of me right here in our own country.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
There were Choctaws in Alabama, Chippewas in St. Paul, Mississippi mud runs like a river in me. America, oh, she's like a mother to me.
You can hear more with Lori Erickson in our show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. An intercontinental pilot tells us how to land a plane in just a bit. But first, the head of the World Monuments Fund reminds us what it takes to protect endangered heritage sites around the world. You're listening to Travel with Rick Steves.
My name is Fabian Brügger, and this is a tongue twister in German. Brautkleid bleibt Brautkleid und Blaukraut bleibt Blaukraut. And what that means is a wedding gown is a wedding gown and blue weed is blue weed. Blaukraut bleibt Blaukraut und Brautkleid bleibt Brautkleid.
For 60 years, the World Monuments Fund has led the way in conserving the world's irreplaceable treasures, architectural and cultural sites that span the diversity of human civilization. Every 2 years, they identify 25 sites under threat from some of our most pressing global challenges and raise the call to action to preserve them. To help us understand what's endangered and what it takes to protect them and why, we're joined now by the World Monuments Fund President and CEO, Bénédicte de Montfleur. Bénédicte, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Rick.
You know, this is a travel show, and lots of people who are enthusiastic about traveling tune into us every week. And a lot of us aren't really mindful or aware of the fact that many of the great cultural sites that we travel so far and wait so long and dream so much about to see are fragile and they're under threat by various challenges. Tell us about the mission of the World Monuments Fund to protect these treasures of our civilization.
Thank you so much, Rick. And indeed, people are not always aware of what it takes to preserve the places that they so happily visit. And in fact, like some recent events like the fire at Notre Dame really help people realize that places you take for granted are not there forever if you don't put in place the systems to preserve them. So the mission of World Monuments Fund is to work with communities around the world to preserve heritage. So this takes many different shapes. Sometimes it's some advocacy projects. Sometimes it's some brick and mortar preservation projects. It's very different. We are headquartered in New York, and we have offices in India, in Peru, in France, in the UK, in Spain, Portugal. And we have projects today in 35 countries.
Well, now, as president and CEO of the World Monuments Fund, Benedict, what are your responsibilities and what are your biggest challenges and maybe the big joys?
Well, my responsibilities is to set the strategy with my whole team and with our partners and to have the right staff at the right places and then to make sure that we answer the demands and needs of the communities around the world. And that's sometimes the best thing when you figure out you've made a difference. You know, when you go to Cambodia, you go to Angkor, you see like four temples that World Monuments Fund has restored. Last year, I had the great joy of handing over three of those temples to the Cambodian authorities. That's extraordinary. And wow. Sometimes you feel like, oh my God, how am I going to do this? What are we going to do? When we saw this big earthquake that impacted Turkey and Syria, we were like so desperate and also really wanted to work with the communities there. So since then, we've launched a big project in Antakya to restore like mosque and church and synagogue there. But, you know, in Syria, because of the situation there, we were not able to do anything. And that's heartbreaking because when you know Syria and all the heritage there that is so important to humanity, you really want to be able to do something.
I suppose part of your work is not funding the restoration or funding the protection, but raising awareness of the issue. So people who care can then go, oh, this is a good cause.
Absolutely. Like very often when a site makes it to our watch list, then you see an immediate mobilization. And that's really heartwarming. For example, this year we had a very important modernist place in Argentina. And just the fact that it was put on the watch list a few years ago, the government mobilized and now it's fully restored. And in fact, it got our Knoll Prize for Modernism, which is one of the best restoration we've seen. So you have some great examples like that. So our action goes from raising awareness and advocacy all the way to restoring temples in Cambodia. So you have the whole arc and it all depends on what does our partner on the ground want, what do they need, and then we try to bring it, expertise, funding, helping shape a project, but also raising the profile of the site and the people that care for it.
So every 2 years, you produce this list of 25 sites declared by the World Monuments Fund that should be recognized as important and threatened. And you choose these sites from, I would imagine, many applications. What shapes your priorities in choosing these? Do you have an agenda like, oh, we're concerned about climate, or we're concerned about conflict, or we're concerned about urbanization? That is a trend, and it's challenging many sites. And do you choose one poster child to make that general cause more understood? Or what are your priorities in choosing these 25?
Well, so that's a very bottom-up process. And so we receive, as you said, the nominations from all over the world. We receive hundreds of nominations. And first of all, we analyze the trend. It's really our window on the world. It's how the way we one of the ways in which we interact with many, many partners in the field. And so it's interesting for us to see what are the main challenges quoted by those nominators. And so this year, indeed, you saw lack of funding, you saw climate change, you saw urbanization, but also we can have a refined analysis. We can look at what is happening more in one region versus another. For example, obviously, like the Middle East quoted much more conflict and natural disasters. So that's one thing. But then how we choose, what are our criteria? Well, first of all, it's the significance. You know, what is the cultural significance of this place locally, nationally, internationally? Second is it urgent? Like, do we need to do something right now? Will it make a difference to be on that list? Does it need an action immediate? immediately. And then third is feasibility. Like, can we do a project there? Can we have an impact? So at the end of the day, we try to have a list that is geographically balanced. We want sites that are representative of the diversity of heritage around the world, but that of course emblematic of the big threats and the big challenges that we've observed in all those nominations.
So if you see a trend in the hundreds of nominations, you'll say, well, I can't choose all of these places that are threatened by climate change, but we must choose a couple to raise awareness of climate change in general as a threat to cultural treasures.
Absolutely, because you want people to understand what's happening around the world and what are the big threats to heritage. So, for example, climate change, this year we have on the list the Swahili coast of Africa. You know, all those extraordinary places like Lamu, like Zanzibar, and those places are today threatened by sea level rise and coastal erosion. But closer to home, you have also the lighthouses of Maine that are equally endangered by sea level rise. So we indeed are trying to pick examples that reflect these trends and that people can relate to. Maybe I don't relate to Zanzibar, but maybe I relate to the cultural landscape of Maine.
It's interesting, Benedict, because I just read through all 25 sites that are on the list for this year, and it is a cohesive ensemble of concerns, very carefully balanced and divided from geography and different fundamental causes and so on. And you can learn a lot just from looking in that and trying to analyze the thinking that goes into the selection from the World Monuments Fund. Benedict de Montlaur is with us right now on Travel with Rick Steves to remind us of the global efforts to preserve many of the world's most treasured architectural and cultural gems. Benedict is the president and CEO of the World Monuments Fund and is joining us from their offices in New York City. Every 2 years, the WMF identifies 25 significant sites that are threatened by the pressures of climate change, conflicts, overdevelopment, and neglect. You can see photos from what's on their 2025 watch and learn about their partnerships with communities across the world on their website, wmf.org. Benedict, a lot of money goes into your work and helping these sites. It must be quite expensive, and I understand that philanthropic organizations and individuals who care about your values contribute and empower the work of the World Monuments Fund. If you're talking to a big organization or a big foundation that has a lot of money to develop, to invest, how do you make the case that this is a good investment? What's a concrete example of how somebody's money can go to you and then save something that is really important for posterity, for the heritage, for the future, to be able to look back and appreciate from where we came?
Well, so I think the point to make is that it doesn't take a big investment to have a huge impact. And I think one of our examples is really Cambodia. We were the first Western organization to be called in Cambodia after the fall of the Khmer Rouge. And at that time, it was a landscape full of landmines. And as you know, a whole generation of people with education, of course, people who are specialists of preservation had been decimated. So they definitely needed help. So we started working at those temples, but also training people while doing so. And it's so interesting to see that at the beginning, when we just arrived in Cambodia, we had to bring a lot of international experts because everybody with an education had been killed or displaced, etc. But today, our whole team is Cambodian. Cambodia. And so it's extraordinary. And you go to Siem Reap and you see like this flourishing town, you see these millions of tourists, all those people having jobs because of what? Because of an archaeological site, because of historic preservation. So the impact of your investment, I mean, over 30 years, maybe we've invested $20 million, but how much money has been reinvested in the community? How many millions of jobs? So I think that's one of the best examples of what is the potential impact of historic preservation.
Benedict, you are a French diplomat working to head an organization, a nonprofit organization, the World Monuments Fund in New York City. And we're entering into a time in our country which is Make America Great Again, MAGA. Now, the thinking for a lot of good people is we need to take care of ourselves first. How can you relate to somebody with a Make America Great Again attitude that America is needed at the table for a global initiative like what your mission is? Is America needed for this?
Yeah, I mean, America is amazing, first of all, because of its philanthropic culture. Doesn't exist anywhere else, like this generosity of the American people. And I think this is something Americans shouldn't turn their back on. They have something to teach everywhere else, that individuals themselves, through their philanthropy, at whatever level, they can make a difference for what they care about. And it's about themselves. You know, heritage in Africa maybe doesn't relate to you as well as heritage in Maine, but at the end, it's the history of humanity. It's the history of our ancestors. So I think we have to care for that, and we have to preserve that because it enriches you as humans. And so that's, I think, really important. And also you can have an important impact, like economic impact. You will have a more stable world if we know where we come from. At the moment, I think there is a lot of loss of identities. People want to know who they are. People want to relate to their origins, their cultures. I think this is also what MAGA is about. And what we should see is that that relates to everyone knowing where they come from and where humanity comes from. And it takes a whole, like, vast array of cultures that we have to learn about.
You know, that's building bridges instead of building walls. And a lot of people want to build walls to be safer, but I really believe if you build bridges, you'll be safer. When we have more connections between cultures, and the United States can be such a great contributor to worthy causes like the World Monuments Fund if we take a seat at the table.
We have a great example of that, which is the Bridge of Mostar in ex-Yugoslavia. This region was torn by war. So many people were worried about it. You had a genocide there. And then through historic preservation, along with many other initiatives, of course, it's not the only thing that contributes to peace, but we were able to build projects that brought people together. And it's really difficult in places where you have so much hatred and you have so much that has happened between people. But through concrete project, we can rally people together around something positive and to learn about their culture and what they share in common. And so, yes, we are all about building bridges, sometimes walls, but good walls, walls that reflect history and cultures.
You know, you bring up the bridge in Mostar. That is an emotional thing for me. It's a pointed bridge, one big arch that comes to a point, and it is symbolically where cultures come together in former Yugoslavia. And these cultures were disagreeing and fighting, and there was a heartbreaking war. And they were pummeling this bridge that for centuries has symbolized people coming together. And I was in a little theater in Mostar watching the video of that, and after pummeling and pummeling and pummeling with bombs, it finally crashed into the river. And I was surrounded by people from that community. And there was a community outcry. I could feel the emotions just filling the room as that bridge came down. And now that bridge has been rebuilt and the community is together and there's peace there. And that's a good example in one little tight little example there of what the World Monuments Fund can do.
Exactly.
And when we travel, I've come to a realization lately, we bring home a dual citizenship. We bring home a greater appreciation of what it means to be an American, but also a global citizenship, that we're part of this family of nations. And I just really believe that the World Monuments Fund has a mission to raise awareness of how we're all connected through these cultural treasures.
You're so right, Rick. And it's sometimes difficult to put words on those feelings that are very important, and you've done it really well. But I think for the example of Notre Dame, you know, when Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris was on fire, I don't think, of course, I was sad because I'm French, but it's not only because I'm French. I think all of us around the world felt, wow, that's a little bit of one of our major accomplishments as humans that is going up in flames. And, you know, it was extraordinary. At that time, I was working here as a cultural counselor for the French embassy, and I organized concerts. And all over the U.S., We had thousands of people coming for solidarity concerts for Notre Dame because they felt like Notre Dame was theirs. And this is this feeling that we are promoting all around the world, that this extraordinary places belong to all of us. Of course, they belong first to the communities that are around it. And we work with these communities. We are very local, but we also think that this is our shared heritage, shared humanity, and that we can make a big difference. And in, especially in those dramatic places, like, you know, we are working in the Mosul Museum. Maybe you remember Daesh destroying those lamasus, those statues, and filming it and spreading it around the world because they thought they were pagan statues. I mean, they are really important statues reflecting art history. Today, we are working with the Louvre and the Smithsonian to restore that place and show that it can rally the people of Mosul together as a place to learn about their history, to gather their community, exactly the opposite of what Daesh was doing by destroying those statues and this museum.
Bénédicte de Montlhary, you are an inspiration, and so is the organization that you lead, the World Monuments Fund. Thank you so much for joining us, and best wishes with your important work.
Thank you so much, Rick, for having me on your show and for speaking so eloquently about World Monuments Fund, travel, and the importance of heritage around the world.
By the way, there are two U.S. sites on the WMF's 2025 list: the historic lighthouses, threatened by rising seas along the coast of Maine, and the surviving segments of the Great Trading Path in North Carolina, which connected people, goods, and ideas across the Southeast back in the 17th and 18th centuries. Bénédicte de Montlhary tells us more about the selection process for the watch. You can hear that on Travel with Rick Steves program number 784 from last March. We provide a quick link to it with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Imagine what it's like to have Mark Van Honecker's job as a pilot. Up next, he escorts our imaginations right into the cockpit to reveal the art and science of how to land a plane. Considering how many times I fly each year, I'm fascinated by the seemingly effortless magic that lifts more than 200 tons of aircraft into the wild blue yonder, and especially what it takes to land it safely over and over again. Mark Van Honecker pilots the Boeing 787 Dreamliner on routes between Asia, America, and Europe. He's back with us now on Travel with Rick Steves to share more of his notes from the cockpit on how what goes up must come down. He's even written a fun little book about the art and the science of flying. It's called How to Land a Plane, along with his larger books, Skyfaring and Imagine a City. Mark, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Rick. Thank you.
I just loved reading in your books how you went from a little kid who was enamored with airplanes, and your favorite thing was your illuminated globe that you would spin and imagine going to all these places, and you became a pilot. How does a little kid who dreams about flying end up flying a 787 Dreamliner?
Well, the short answer is step by step. I grew up in Pittsfield, a small city in western Massachusetts, with a small airport where I took my first flying lessons. But I didn't know any commercial pilots. My parents weren't pilots. Aviation often runs in the family, but it didn't really run in mine. So it took me a little longer than some of my colleagues to find my way to a commercial airliner. I started my training when I was in my late 20s, and I first flew an Airbus A320 in 2003 from London to Glasgow. And then in 2007, I flew a 747 for the first time from London to Hong Kong. And then a few years ago, I had my very last and sad, bittersweet flight on the 747 from London to Cape Town. And since then, I've been flying the 787 Dreamliner.
Oh, my goodness. What a career. Now, you've decided to write this book, How to Land a Plane. And it's not exactly a training manual, but it's quite literally a book on how to land a plane. You've got illustrations and definitions, and it's all very accessible to the average flyer. Why did you call it How to Land instead of How to Take Off?
Well, that's a good question. Pilots will often joke that, you know, no one has to take off, but we do need to land. And so the landing is definitely the more technically or professionally interesting part of the job, I would think most pilots would say. And of course, the spoiler alert is you cannot learn to land a plane by reading a book. But I hope that through this book, I can talk a little bit about what you'll learn as a student pilot and eventually as a commercial pilot. And My first book, Skyfaring, was really about the magic of flying and the kind of almost ancient mystery that flying has probably held for us since we could first look up and see birds flying and imagine what it would feel like. And you know, the romance of flying is something that I really wanted to capture in that first book. But there's another way to think about flying, and that's to approach it from those details and to remember that, you know, for all the wonder and magic we might feel when we're flying, these are, in fact, highly, highly specialized and intricately constructed and tested and designed machines that have a particular task. And I wanted to talk about that task, especially the landing.
It's interesting because we've talked before, and I've enjoyed three or four of your books, and you've got this passion of sharing what you really appreciate and love, as if you just, it's like show and tell on Monday morning when you're in third grade. You know, you come back after the weekend, you did something really cool, and you want to share it with your friends. And I've got the same sort of passion about sharing my love of travel, but you've got this great knack for giving us an intimate look at what's it like, you know, in the cockpit. And I don't know if you've ever done this before, but I would like you to pretend you're a sportscaster and you're going to narrate to us what goes on in your mind as you take off, okay? Not landing, but you're just taking off. Give us the sportscaster's play-by-play, blow-by-blow. What's going on? What's happening? What are you thinking about? So take us, please, from the gate to takeoff.
Sure, I'll do my best. Okay, so we are in the cockpit. We have all the doors are closed. We can see on our screens that all the cabin doors and the cargo doors are closed. And we call air traffic for permission to push back. We complete our checklists and we talk to the ground crew who are on the tug. We release the parking brake and they start pushing us back. And while they're pushing us back, we start our engines. We do another checklist. It's all checklists. And then we call air traffic for permission to taxi. Air traffic says to us, okay, it's your turn. Line up runway 27 right and wait. We enter the runway. We make that little cabin chime, which signals to the cabin crew. Suddenly, air traffic say, okay, you're cleared for takeoff. I will put the thrust levers up to an intermediate setting, and we confirm that they're responding as they should. But then we press a switch, which sets the pre-calculated takeoff power, taking into account the wind, which might be a crosswind. And we start rolling down the runway, and then the aircraft will say, announce automatically V1, which is our decision speed in the aircraft. And then when we hit rotate speed, when we pass the rotate speed, the other pilot will say rotate. I will gently ease the nose into the air. Once we can see from the altimeters that we're climbing, the other pilot will say to me positive rate, and I'll ask for the gear up, and they will raise the landing gear, and we are up and away.
Wow. I was with you every second. That's so exciting to me. You mentioned you have a pre-calculated takeoff power. They've actually figured out how much of a throttle you need to give it according to the weight of the plane and the wind and all that kind of thing.
Exactly. Right. Now, we calculate that ourselves using a computer program, which is on the aircraft. And it takes into account the wind, the temperature, the air pressure, whether the runway is wet or not, and of course, most fundamentally, the weight of the aircraft. So it's extremely rare that we take off at full power.
I always think, in a kind of a scary kind of way, there's a point you reach where you can no longer safely abort this takeoff, where you've got to go up now. You can't say, no, let's not.
Yeah, so what you're asking about is a speed called V1, and V1 is the last speed at which you would stop on the runway. So after V1, everything has been calculated so that you will get airborne.
You've got to go. There's no turning back.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and it's funny. Sometimes aviation, little bits of its language kind of get out into popular culture. You know, when you're landing, the plane will actually say decide to you. And so I have some friends who work in the business world. And, you know, one of them wants me to record it sometime so he can just in meetings just play, you know, decide, you know, when he's in some long-winded meeting with his colleagues at work. And V1 is another, you know, it definitely has its metaphorical possibilities as well.
Like, yeah.
You know, maybe, I don't know if you've ever had that as, you know, when you're driving sometimes and you're pulling out into an intersection, and if you hesitate too much, then that's actually not what you're meant to do
right.
as a driver.
Right. I always say, if there's any question of if I should go or not, I'm just not going to go and I'll wait until there's a better opening or something. Mark Van Honecker is an intercontinental pilot who writes about the view from the cockpit and about science, culture, and the places he gets to visit. Mark writes an ode to the wonder of flight in his book Skyfaring and tells us about his favorite cities to land in Imagine a City. You can hear those conversations in his previous visits with us on Travel with Rick Steves. Right now, Mark's telling us about the art and science of flying and covers every step of the process in his book How to Land a Plane. Mark's website is skyfaring.com. Okay, Mark, the book is called How to Land a Plane,
If you don't mind, I really enjoyed that sportscaster's blow-by-blow account of taking off. Now we've been flying for 6 or 8 hours, and we're ready to land at Heathrow in London. Can you do a blow-by-blow account of what goes on from cruising speed to all of a sudden, everybody put on your seatbelts, we're going to land, and get us all the way to the gate here?
Okay, well, let's say it's about an hour and a quarter before landing. You're coming, we're on a flight from Seattle to Heathrow, somewhere over Ireland. In the cockpit, we're doing our descent brief. So we're talking about what's different about today. You know, what are the weather conditions? What are our minimum safe altitudes on the way in? Which runway are we planning to land on? What if they change the runway? All those kind of things that go into a standard descent brief. And then about an hour before landing, we conduct the descent checklist. Everything has a checklist in aviation. About 25 minutes or so before landing, we'll start our descent, depending on how high we are, what our cruising altitude is. So we'll get that first descent clearance from London. We know we'll descend at chunks of 3,000 or 4,000 feet at a time. About 20 minutes before landing, we'll put the seatbelt signs on, and then we'll be speaking to a series of air traffic controllers. Eventually, we'll speak to one who has the awesome call sign of Heathrow Director, and they are among the best trained air traffic controllers in the world. They are supervising the arrivals into one of the busiest airports in the world, and they will sequence us from our arrival route onto a runway. Eventually, we'll be at maybe 4,000 or 5,000 feet above London. So if it's a clear day, which it isn't always in London, passengers will be able to see all those sites below us, St. Paul's Cathedral and the Houses of Parliament and the palaces and the parks and, of course, the Great River. And meanwhile, on the flight deck, we're looking inside at our instruments, of course, and then outside. Of course, as we're going, we're slowing down, and we'll be extending those panels that come out of the front and the back of the wings. They basically make the wing bigger and change its shape. I talk quite a lot about them and how to land a plane. About 2,000 feet above the ground, we'll lower the landing gear. And then you won't be surprised to hear there's another checklist. And then as we're coming down, the plane is speaking to us, and it's announcing our altitudes, which is one of the coolest things to hear. So it's saying 1,000, you know, meaning 1,000 feet above the ground. And then it says 500. And then at some point, it'll say decide, which is when you've reached your decision altitude, which is the altitude at which you need to be able to see elements of the runway lighting or the runway itself. Of course, on a clear day, you've already seen it miles before, but on a misty day, it might be a little bit closer to that decide call. And it'll say 100, 50, 30. And some point after 30, we will very gently ease the nose up. And a few seconds after that, the rear wheels touch. And when they touch the spoilers, which are those panels on the wing that come out, and they basically stop the wing from working. They're called spoilers because they spoil the lift on the wing. And that brings the aircraft's full weight onto the wheels, and the brakes kick in. The engines we put in reverse, and once we're slow enough, we taxi off the runway and turn onto the gate. We say cabin crew, doors to manual and cross-check, set the parking brake, shut off the engines, do a few more procedures and checklists. And then it's time to stand up and put my hat on and go and say goodbye to our customers.
Wow. Do you enjoy standing there at the cockpit and saying goodbye to the customers?
I do. I do. You know, on a long-haul, wide-body airliner, we don't really see very many of our customers.
Right.
The cabin crew, of course, interact with them throughout the flight. But as pilots, we have a much more limited interaction with them. Right. And, you know, often... times the we see them most in the window of the terminal.
Do you remember the days when little kids could go into the cockpit and meet the pilot and see all the panels?
Well, I was that kid, It meant so much to me. And, you know, that's really one of the things I really want to do as a writer and as a pilot is communicate not just the facts of it, but what it feels like to be a pilot, because the next generation of pilots is not having those experiences.
No.
And I want to encourage everyone who loves aviation to think about a career in it, because it's a really wonderful job.
I miss that. Well, when I was little, it was very, very exciting to be able to see the pilot and just poke your head into the cockpit. And to this day, I'm always glad when the pilot's there, because I can say, good flight. Thanks.
Well, we still welcome visitors before the flight and after the flight, if there's time. So I've got stickers in my bag that say, you know,
oh, good.
I visited the flight deck, and still some old postcards, which I think have Concorde.
Those
on
little
them.
Pins for kids with the wings on them.
Yeah, we have stickers rather than pins, but yeah.
After piloting the 747 for years, Mark Van Honecker is flying the Boeing 787 Dreamliner from London to cities all around the world. He's written a small volume with the curious title, How to Land a Plane. You'll also see Mark's byline on travel articles in the New York Times and in the Financial Times.
You can listen to Mark's earlier visits with us and find a link to his website at ricksteves.com/radio. Mark, a lot of people are still afraid of flying, fear of flying. And it's an emotion. It's not a logical thing. But can you help somebody not be afraid of flying? How do you approach that?
That's a really good question. And I always have a lot of sympathy for people when they describe their nerves or anxiety about flying, mm-hmm. because for me, it's such a wonderful experience, and I want to share that. When I wrote Skyfaring, I didn't mean for that book to necessarily soothe people who are nervous flyers, but I got mm-hmm. a lot of emails from people saying that it had that effect, which was a lovely experience for me as a writer, because you know that book is quite emotional in some ways, or it's not really very technical, and
right.
that it had that effect on people was, you know, what more could I want as a writer?
You know, I've struggled with that myself because I have had friends or loved ones that just were not comfortable flying, and I'm comfortable on a boat because a boat goes in water and water has mass. And I think it's important for a nervous flyer to know that air has mass too, more mass than what we would know. Also, a pilot once told me that as long as you're wearing your seatbelt, turbulence, he could take such great turbulence that you would have bruises from your seatbelt before he would worry about that turbulence endangering people on the flight.
So those are great points. One of my colleagues who runs a course for nervous flyers, he says turbulence may be uncomfortable, but it is never dangerous. And that is true. If you have your seatbelt on, it may be uncomfortable, but it is not dangerous.
And then you can just relate to people statistically. I mean, every day, thousands of planes take off and land safely in the United States. We're talking commercial airlines. And entire years go by without a fatality in the commercial airline industry, whereas we lose tens of thousands of people on the road as just a consequence of traveling fast on four wheels.
That's correct. And I think I must not be the only pilot who's had the feeling of, you know, after you fly across the world, you land at a major airport, you taxi and you park, and then a few hours later you're on the road, like on a busy highway, and you think, this is crazy. I can't believe these people are just allowed to, like, who's controlling
this?
That
is so interesting from a pilot's sensibility, how dangerous it is to on an on-ramp of a freeway.
Yeah, I mean, and you'll see someone, like, driving by, and they're, I don't know, they're texting or doing whatever they're not meant to do.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, in the aviation environment, everyone is safely controlled by air traffic controllers and by other means. And so a highway looks downright chaotic after a flight across the world.
Well, and also you've got this dedication to safety, obviously. You've got these checklists, and you don't do anything that has any risk. There's no acceptable risk, I wouldn't think.
I agree, and I want to return also to your point about sailing and how you feel more comfortable on the water, but how air has mass too. And I think it's really important to understand that air, you know, air is a fluid as well. In fact, fluid dynamics is what aerodynamics is a part of. And when I was writing How to Land a Plane, I was talking with other pilots, and one pilot, she and I were trying to find an intuitive way to explain how planes fly. You know, something that would really explain how we're just not up there in a vacuum. We were actually,
right.
You know, we're acting on a fluid. And she had this amazing analogy of water skiing. And it's a really useful analogy in a number of ways, because if you notice, planes are always pointing up slightly. Even when they're moving horizontally, they're pointing up a bit.
Yeah.
And that's true for water skis, and it's for the same reason.
Yeah.
If you want to get into even a little bit of the aerodynamics, when planes are flying more slowly, their noses are farther up,
okay.
or higher up.
Well, that would make sense when you think of air has mass. And you wrote about that, Mark, quite a bit in your book, How to Land a Plane. You talked about how pilots know that a bird can fly longer and with less effort when low to the ground, or sometimes the air begins to act like a pillow. I mean, just to think about that, aerodynamics, is that what you are?
That's right, yeah. That's a good word for it.
You know, and you mentioned this whole analogy to sailing and water. You also point out how pilots and people in the aeronautics use nautical terms. You got port, starboard, wake, fleet, aft, galley. Where did all these nautical terms, how did they all of a sudden get airborne?
And of course, captains and officers and decks and, you know, so many of the other words that you mentioned. I think a lot of it came from the founder of Pan Am. I think he was very conscious of a transition between the ocean-going liners and aviation. And I think Joe Sutter, the man who was the lead designer of the Boeing 747, you know, he talked about wanting the 747 to have the stately majesty of liners.
Mm.
And so that connection is still there.
And the Dreamliner. There you
yeah,
go.
Yeah. Sometimes when, you know, so many of my flights cross the equator, and, you know, I think in the old days, that was an occasion for champagne for passengers. And even in some navies, there was a chance for, you know, some kind of celebration or yeah. ritual.
Oh, yeah.
And whenever we crossed the equator on an airliner, I kind of wish there was still that momentousness for the customers. Of course, we're not going to wake them up in the middle of the night to tell them. But it's a nice thing to think about all the same.
Ah, this is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Mark Van Honecker about How to Land a Plane. That's the name of Mark's book. And to learn more about the behind-the-scenes wonder of aviation, keep that name in mind, Mark Van Honecker. Mark, thank you so much, and smooth flying.
Thank you, Rick. See you on board.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kaz Murrah-Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Website uploads are by Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. You'll find more about our guests at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Hey, I'm Rick Steves. It's clear to me that if you equip yourself with good information and expect yourself to travel smart, you will. That's why we offer a world of free content at ricksteves.com. All the TV shows we've ever produced, that's over 100 shows taking you from Turkey to Poland to Portugal. 50 hours of practical lectures, with talks ranging from packing smart and tech on the road to cruising and language lessons. There's articles covering every corner of Europe, a thriving family of travelers comparing notes in our forum, and much more. And it's all entirely free at ricksteves.com.